This is a tape of John Russell Brown, who spoke at the University of Washington School of Drama Colloquium on February 6th, 1989.
Introducing to you, unfortunately, I just met 5 minutes ago, the one that tried to fake my very wonderful introduction and read just some sections from a press release provided by the Empty Space Theater, which will, I think, tell you something about our guest. John Russell Brown is an associate of the National Theatre of Great Britain, an artistic director of the Project Theatre at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor. He's head of the script department of the National Theatre, advising on repertoire, and new plays and translations, and contributing to forward plans and development. He's director for the Crucible Theatre, Sheffield, Playhouse, Nottingham, The Everyman, Liverpool, and London, and Bush, and the theatre upstairs at the Royal Courts. Hamlet, Peter Goldheim's Canada for British Council called India Tour. He's also worked in several capacities in television, including a series of 9 programs, the BBC show Shakespeare's Plays and Rehearsal, and 2 short documentary films, etc., etc. Graduate of Oxford, he was head of the Department of Drama and Theatre Arts at the University of Birmingham, and professor of English at Sussex University. Published many books, play editions, and articles, including art editions of Merchant of Venice. And he's also written a wonderful book that I've never read called Free Shakespeare, published in 1974. So may I have your kind, warm welcome.
That's nearly all true. Not exactly, because since that press release was drawn up, I have left the National Theatre after 15 years and am now a freelance director, as well as in charge of graduate work at the University of Michigan and in charge of a very small scale professional theatre there called Project Theatre. I wonder what it would be profitable to talk about. You may have questions from that biography where you may have been interested in one or other of the various jobs I've tried to do in theatre. I've tried to teach, I've tried to help a major theatre do good plays for its audience. I have tried to build audiences. I've taken plays across Europe for the British Council and indeed to India. And I've worked in a number of regional theatres in England and I'm beginning for the first time to work in regional theatres in this country. So there's a lot there which I could be talking about. There's one thing that comes from it. That it's not very easy to find a single line to satisfy oneself in the theatre, and that I've had to work in many different ways to keep my head above water and to try to find circumstances in which work seems to be good. I think that's a problem which most people face if they try to work in theatre. It's not only one branch of theatre making one is involved with, it's also on what level one works, in what sort of financial circumstances, in what kind of, with what kind of colleagues, and so forth. There's all the difference between dropping out of an aeroplane and trying to do some work in a theatre already established where you are a guest and the first few weeks is trying to find the nature of the local circumstances to try to find out how best one can function in that theatre. And that's quite different from trying to tenaciously build up a theatre of one's own where one draws together a group of people who can work on long-term projects, who can go underground for some time while certain parts of the great plot, which is making theatre, are brought together. I could talk about very, very small theatres where one works on a single script with perhaps three actors for a year. That is a kind of discipline and adventure which has very, very positive results. I can tell you about working in a theatre which has a company of 100 actors and a complete company of somewhere between 600 and 700 people. That also, if you can understand your group well enough, can be very, very stimulating and advantageous. It can also be a huge break upon one's own individuality, so you find yourself feeding the system rather than doing what one needs to do oneself, which after all is the center of most people beginning with theatre. What I thought I'd try to talk about in some detail is my first theatre, my very, very, very first theatre. I must have been about 9 years of age. My brother and I lived with my father and mother over a retail shop in a place called Bristol in the West Country. And my mother and father both worked in that shop, and it shut at 8 o'clock at night. And that was all right when we kids were young enough to knock on the head and put down to sleep at 5 or 6 or 7. They had a few hours of peace to themselves at the end of the evening, but at the end of the day's work. But the problem came when we were 10, 11, 12, 13, and they tried to put us to bed before 8 o'clock, and it was very difficult indeed. Well, we had one room with two single beds back over the top of the shop, and we used to have to entertain ourselves. And what we did was to tell each other stories, and what we did was to push the two beds together, or apart, depending on what sort of stage we wanted, and we made plays. And we made plays which travelled the whole world. My favourite role, I have to say, was a pirate. On a sailing ship, roughly at the end of the 18th century. I didn't know about centuries in those days, but I know from the kind of weapons I was using, it must have been right about there. I can remember some of the escapades with great vividness. My brother, on the other hand, who was older than me, his favourite role was that of a little dog. I don't think in any way that I was bullying him. I think he was much bigger than me. He liked being a little dog because he could get to all sorts of places and up to all sorts of mischief which mere human beings didn't have a chance of doing. And he used to tell endless stories, and they became endless plays. But that wasn't enough. There we were locked upstairs, and after 8 o'clock, we could hear the shop door shut, and my parents came up and had their well-earned, I hope, supper together before they toddled off to bed at 11 o'clock. And the play used to get quieter and quieter and quieter as midnight approached. And then, of course, that wasn't enough. And the point is that that wasn't enough. We had to find ways of bringing our plays and showing them. Well, we lived over a shop on a quite busy road in Bristol. And so our set, we then decided to excerpt bits of our work and show them to our family and to anybody else we could get. And we developed a whole range of plays which had an open window as part of the set, because we could always speak to people passing by in the street. And we brought that sort of reality. And these were the days, I'm old enough to be living on a main road where there were tram cars going up and down with open decks at the top. So you could actually shoot peas if you've done that. at people sitting on top of the tram car, but you could also see things to them. And they'd go past our stage like this. And we could imagine they were going to the stage where. So we were always improvising. And always the best parts of the play we found were those where we managed to make the world outside our window part of the play inside. Now, I've never had a theatre quite like that again, and I never will. But it started me off knowing that theatre was the job of making sense of where one is, making sense of what one is, and trying to show it to other people. And if one, I think, if I look back, which I don't like doing, because I don't, well, I don't mind doing, but I prefer to look forward. If one looks back, all the good theatre I've done has included that threefold job. And the advantage of doing all that is that you discover what you are and what you need to do for the next year. Because I have one absolutely foolproof recipe for knowing what is good theatre. Good theatre is work done in the theatre which makes it necessary to do more work. That you have achieved so much, and by achieving so much, it may be quite little on some fronts, but by achieving that, you immediately want to go and make more. Make something different. Go on from that hill. It's like mountaineering. You climb one hill and you think, my God, I'm at the top of the world. And you get to the top of the hill and there are other mountains ahead of you which are much taller than the one which had been obliterating their view. As you were clambering up the rock fence in the attempt to reach what you thought at that moment was the apex of achievement. And so I've come to have those sort of four rules for what makes a good theatre, right? Quietly, when I reflect on what I'm doing, I try to apply those kinds of judgments. It's very easy to accept hype. By the time anything is famous, it's usually dead in the theatre, and you go there to see what critics have told you to see, and you try to be as excited as the critics in the first production were, and you often find it very hard to go. But it doesn't matter where it is, as long as what it is doing is showing something in the theatre which hasn't been seen before. And it's showing, and people showing it are there discovering something about the world in which they live and about themselves. And they are open to your curiosity. And if you talk to them, they're speaking not about the past, but they're speaking about the future. Those aren't the modes of criticism which make good journalism, but they are modes of criticism which I think help people as they try to find places to work and the means of working. And to try to find out theatre which is good to go to. Perhaps I've spoken too abstractly to interest you, but it may be that by starting abstractly and going back to being 8 years old, I may have, I hope I have, and some of you, awakened some sort of curiosity about work in progress, work being done in London at this time, or in New York, or in other places in this country. Or perhaps because of my work in the film department at the National Theatre, there may be questions you'd like to ask about British writers, or about the relationship of writers to the theatre company. And what is very, very important, and growing more so, the relationship between directors and writers in the theatre. So, I can tell you some stories, but I'd rather just pause for a minute and ask if there's any questions which my generalities may have roused in your mind. Yes?
Just
Yes. Yes, I can easily talk about that. And I think one of the most... I haven't worked in a regional theatre in this country yet. I've only just cut myself free from London to be able to work over here. But I'm now preparing a production of Much Ado at Cincinnati and Playhouse in the Park. And so over the last 6 months, I've been somewhat engaged there with designers and casting directors and artistic directors and the like. And happily, I'm here in Seattle working at the Empty Space. But I've been to lots of regional theatres, and actually a script of mine was done at Hartford Stage. I can't say a play of mine was done at Hartford Stage. It was a version of Mystery Plays, which I did for a director called Anne Robinson, who the designer I was working with happened to know. And she wanted a version of the English Mystery Plays, which could be performed by no more than 6 actors. And so I did a version for her, and I got to work at Hartford Stage. And also, I've been in Washington, D.C. quite a bit, and I know people both at the Folger and at the Arena. But that's the sort of the limitation of my regional theatre knowledge here. But I do at once see huge differences. And one of the main differences is the audience. You see, we don't have subscriptions. We don't buy season tickets. Now, I went to Hartford Stage, and the show which we were doing there, they had sold somewhere over 8% of tickets in advance, no matter what it was like. And if they had a bummer show, they still went on playing it for 30 performances, whatever it was, and nobody came, which was misery. And if they had a show which was really alive to life in Hartford now, whatever that might be, and the 8% seats sold in advance already taken up, that only allowed 20% of the seats, and they were always the worst seats, to be filled by people who had heard, hey, there's a play, which is good. And so I found Hartford Stage was like sort of living in the middle of Putty. What you got back from the audience was a sense that they were coming to see their play. And now, I quite like the audience to own the theatre, but I also like the actors to have to win the audience. And I love the situation where a play can actually take off, find its audience, and grow in confidence as that happens. I think it's very difficult to conceive of a theatre which does good work when the audience is 80% guaranteed before the show opens, and that there is no chance of prolonging the run unless you can hold the gang together to the end of the season. It's a much more dangerous line in England in the regional theatre. That's the first difference I would find between British regional theatre and theatre over here. The other great difference, of course, is this is a big country. And to get people to leave New York or Los Angeles or wherever they're based, to go to Cincinnati or where shall we say, Louisville or St. Louis, or to Hartford. Hartford's not too bad because they can dash back to New York. It's very difficult to get the best actors to undertake work in the regional theatre here, whereas in Britain it's much easier. And because we don't do seasons in the same way, the planning process is much shorter. I mean, I knew I was doing a Shakespeare play at Cincinnati about 15 months ago. No, 13 months ago. January last year, 13 months ago. And it's been cooking all that time. And I also think that once actors have come, this is a plus in this country, once actors have come to a region, this is the distinction about musical theatre in this country, that once actors are there, they feel they're on a raft in the middle of an ocean. They don't belong to the place. And the place they belong to is aircraft journey aware, a flight aware. And their home, their friends, their family, their next job, all happens over there. And that is one of the main reasons why when I first came to Seattle about a year ago, I was absolutely excited by the theatrical climate here. The people I met here working in theatre were not on a little raft all by themselves making something in the middle of a wilderness. The actors I talked to there were working for 2, 3, or 4 companies within a single year. Most of them, ones I met, had done 3 or 4 really good parts under different directors, often in different theatres. And they were in charge of their lives in a way which is very, very difficult to be in charge of your life if you're dependent on getting appointments back in New York. Or it's very difficult to be in charge of your life unless you join one of the big companies in England. But here, you can, as you're doing one job, keep your eye on 3 or 4 different theatres, or I suspect it's true to say that 3 or 4 different theatres keep their eye on your work. And that kind of community here, with people who have a range of work in theatre without having to be vagabonds, is a terrific plus for this city. And as far as I know, unique in the world. Now, it can lead, I suspect, to a kind of smugness because everybody's nice to each other, because if you're not nice to each other, you won't get work, you'll be considered a sore thumb. I don't know. That is obviously the danger of this theatre group which is here. But for somebody coming in to meet these people with this variety of experience, I find it incredibly stimulating. But it's certainly not the case in the other regional theatres I've been in this country, and in England, you may stay in a regional theatre for 2 or 3 years, but there's the centre of the theatre profession is London. There is absolutely no casting of any work done anywhere else except in London. London is the centre of television, it's the centre of film, it's the centre of theatre. That is an advantage in England, is that it's all very cozy. And now, it is possible for all the theatres throughout England to feel part of one great family. But it's not the same as living on a day-to-day basis in the same town, confronting the same climate, feeling the same political pressure. And I think Seattle probably has advantages in theatre making and for making a theatre career, which is another matter, which are probably unparalleled in. But they are unparalleled in my experience. Yeah.
You said that you had a few questions about the relationship between directors and playwrights.
Yes.
I was wondering if you had good experience working with a particular ensemble of actors generating material in a three-way street.
Yes, a big example of that in England is the Joint Stock Theatre Company, who invite various dramatists to join the company to develop plays for those particular actors. And there's a large number of good British dramatists who have worked in that way, usually once. I refer to David Hare Van Shen, I refer to Epsom Downs, I think probably high-breaking bestseller, as a matter of fact. Mad World, My Masters, a version of Jacobean comedy by Barry Keith. What was that thing about stock exchange, which Carol Churchill did? Serious Money, yes. There's been a number of plays developed in that work. But they usually use one dramatist once. Stephen Lowe also did Ragged Trousers Philanthropist, I don't know if you know that. And that, in each case, has brought a revaluation of the way of working to the dramatist. And I mean, ups and downs requires more from the actors, I think, except possibly Romans and Britain, which has its own peculiar demands. But I think ups and downs demands more from the actors than any other play by Howard Brenton. And I think he was kind of almost bullied into doing it, or rather, perhaps he, having this opportunity, sort of pushed himself in directions which he wouldn't have gone otherwise. But generally speaking, I think the dramatists who work over a prolonged period with a company tend very much to lose their own voice and become kind of play makers rather than play writers. There are exceptions, of course, when the playwright is also the director. I don't know if you know Mike Lee's work over here, Abigail's Father, where he is director and author, or rather he's the lead author of a group of actors who he gets to improvise and go out into the streets or the dance palaces or the real estate market and work in specific jobs and from that bring it back to the studio, improvise, and he as director and writer chooses from what they are doing and shapes together a play. The shape of his plays are quite often fairly conventional and unexciting, but the great value on them is the authenticity and sometimes the punch with which it brings real life onto the stage. I can't think of an example in Britain of somebody who works in a kind of equal relationship to actors and directors and has achieved a single voice, a distinctive voice. But what is necessary for writers, I think, is to find a director who can help them establish themselves. Most writers, when they start, good writers, when they start, try to do things that nobody else has done. And it's very difficult to move into a theatre and get the kind of basic work done in understanding, which allows the piece to reach full power in performance. And most of the dramatists I know have been very dependent on a director in their early days. Howard Brenton depended on David Hare. David Hare depended on David Hare. Edward Bond was very fortunate at the World Court, and he had a couple of directors who were working with him. Harold Pinter was enormously fortunate in finding first John McQuinney and then Peter Hall, who could come to their work with a knowledge of previous texts and also a knowledge of something else, and that's the knowledge of where the play comes from. That is, to be knowledgeable of the imagination and the experience and the memory of the writer. To be able to be sensitive to those parts of the writing which are most unlike plays which have been done before. And that's the most important part of a new play. The thing to do is not to sort of dragoon it into a conventional shape so that everybody is perfectly content with it. The job is to try to hold on to what is unique, what is being said or done for the first time. And if the dramatist has to go from director to director and theatre to theatre, he or she may find they're spending the time being groomed. A lot of authors cheat and try and direct their own plays. I think that they're very strong-minded and it can work. But there's lots of examples of that going wrong too. I mean, Robert Holman's an interesting case, actually. He got, I think it's fair to say, got stuck with Chris Parr for his first few plays, who did understand. He came from the same part of the world as Robert Holman, and he was able to catch that sort of very gentle, non-literary lyricism, which seems to me to be a very important part of Robert's play. But in a way, Chris, it came a time when Chris was standing in the way because he was developing a career in television and Robert was left without a director. I got him as a resident dramatist at the National Theatre and we tried several directors on him and vice versa, and it never really worked. And then he found a home with the RSC and is now working again in a fairly consistent way. And it's incredibly important to get that support, I think. Yeah.
It seems to me that Raven is a lot of more distinct political voice than playwriting. Of course, more political playwriting in the United States.
Yeah.
Is that your view? And so why do you think that is? I mean, I think people like Aaron Brennan and Bond who, really have distinct political things to say.
Yeah. Yes, I'm probably going to say something which isn't very popular. I think here there is much more a place for the dramatist to function. We don't have, I don't think there's a single course in playwriting in Great Britain. Here, I think that a young dramatist can find that there is a way of, that is where their basis is. There is a ready and easy way of doing their plays, perhaps not very well, perhaps brilliantly, perhaps very sensitively, but it takes place within a kind of closed environment. Whereas if you go to the younger writers in Britain, you will find that most of them have never been in any playwriting course. But they've had to come to this country to do it. They have had to earn their keep as writers, which is different from earning your keep as a playwright on a job. And they, most of them have worked for radio a great deal, and that's another huge difference. There's still a really considerable demand for radio drama in Britain. And it is a way of not merely getting some money, but actually at least hearing what one's done in a kind of finished form, often by very, very good actors. And the same thing goes for television drama. I mean, most of there are regional television companies and they do have local writers, but most of the work comes out of London, where most of the playwriting. And there's lots of work to do on television. Indeed, it's somewhat seductive in writing, you know, serials and things like this. But if you hold out for writing plays, I mean, well, Holman has done a number of television plays, which have been very important for him to keeping his body and soul together as he was developing. But he was doing that work in the open marketplace. And I think once you start working with the realities and making theatre, or more so, making film, or working with journalists, you are aware of political pressures of a different sort from the micro political pressures of a university theatre department or an arts foundation somewhere or other. And you are involved in real world. I mean, take a play like Carlsberg, which Hargrave and David Hare wrote, that comes out immediately out of their work in coping with doing the odd article for the Sunday newspaper, in getting their own work reviewed, in going around and giving interviews to people who would hopefully write good stuff about their work and not give away all the bad secrets, and so forth. And there they are. They live in the world. Now there's take an American dramatist whose political consciousness could hardly be more acute. That's Wallace Shawn, who has grown up with some sense of political environment in New York. Not to say with the New Yorker, a sense of the pressures on the world. Yet when he writes a political play, which I take Lemon and Ardan to be, a deeply political play, it isn't done with reference to anybody else except people like himself. I don't mean to say that he's the characters in the play, but they live in the world in which he lives. And that is not a world of the world of Carver, for example. The world of really tough political ordinary things, with big financial economic pressures and matters of that sort. He's lived a very tough life. He's done all sorts of drab jobs in order to be a writer. But they have been in isolation, and they've been very lonely jobs, but nothing to do with writing in any form or another. He's never, as far as I know, worked for radio. I mean, his career is one of pertinacity and then a lucky break because he's terribly funny on film. And he's got himself, so that he's now writing about one play every 5 years, by a great deal of perseverance, as well as very, very considerable skill. But he's a deeply political writer, it seems to me, in his own terms, which are not the public terms of many British dramatists. I think also our playwrights are more politically conscious because our audiences are truer. A good regional theatre here has subscription audiences. There's certain things which are almost unacceptable to such a subscription audience. Once you get to a position where you can fork out however many dollars it is for seats in advance, there's a certain kind of political posture which tends to go with that, not in every case, of course. And nor do I think that plays for one particular group of people are necessarily bad plays. I don't think that's true at all. But it does limit the political relevance of writing. I mean, in a way, David Mamet is a political writer, but he's a political writer in a very mythic and generalized sense. He may take a group of people from the gritty part of life, which he knows more or less, and I think it depends on how well he knows the characters and their milieu, how good a play he writes. And he does actually put them into situations which are to do with power, which are to do with money, which are to do with organizations, which are to do with the individual against society, and so on and so on. But they tend to be very small and compact plays. I think Gengar Genlos is the most widely relevant in his plays, and that comes out of the precise experience which David had, not as a playwright, but as somebody involved with a job in real estate. But you see, to take a play which I very much admire, Turn This. Now, it is possible to say that there is a political point in that play, but by God, you've got to seek for it. And what point it makes politically seems to me to be deeply conservative. The way that Hale turns out, in fact, to be a good family man who's trying to live with his high school sweetheart, married with children, and is working his butt off to keep this supposedly inane wife in a home of the sort she wants, and then he, poor man, suddenly sees this beautiful dancer who is able to give him a notion of some other kind of female figure. And at the end, he becomes a kind of, I don't know whether he's a victim to her spirituality or whether he is held by some virgin in a kind of theater at the end, so he represents the southern society, which has destroyed him. I don't know, take your pick. As a political play, it doesn't cover much ground, it seems to me. I think it's a marvelous play, and I'm looking forward to doing it. But I'm doing it because it seems to me about a dancer and about people who don't understand their secret paradise, their central self. Yes?
Would you comment on the utilization of the Arts Council and where we are with regard to buyer fiction and the fact that it does impact on the Arts Council?
Yes. Well, yes, that's a difficult question. I was chairman of the drama panel of the Arts Council for about 3 years, and a member of the Finance and General Purposes Committee, which meant that I and 4 other people with the officers of the Arts Council disbursed £91 million in the last year I was holding that position. And in those days, I think, it was accepted that theatre was a dinosaur which could only be kept alive by injection of special kind of oxygen called money. And if you gave it enough, it was good, and if you didn't give it enough, the species would just continue and wouldn't be too much trouble. and half the time they gave a good deal and the dinosaurs were almost frisky, but most of the time they gave very little and the dinosaurs lunged and plunged and breathed deeply and hoped to survive. And there was a marvellous phrase going around the Arts Council when cuts began to be envisaged, and that was the theory of equal misery for all, which seems to me one of the worst possible ways of distributing money to the arts. That means you snip a bit off of everybody's budget and yet you can get on without it. Of course, appalling things immediately happened in the shortage of money. The first thing, plays with only 2 characters suddenly bristled all over the place. And the number of actors employed plummeted. Back in 1965, I think it was, the general proportion between money paid to actors and money paid to the rest of the theatre company was somewhere between a quarter and a third of the expenditure of a theatre. It's now down to about an eighth. And that's one way where they think they can economise. The other way, which seems to me to be disastrous, and that is to reduce the weeks of rehearsal, because the audience will never know. They will know if the actors aren't wearing splendid clothes. They will know if there aren't splendid stages, settings and wonderful light and sound. The audience will recognize what's put on the table before the dinner is laid. But you play enough music, tell them they're going to enjoy themselves, and you can serve up, what do you say, couple of cool slices of I don't know what, chicken breast or something, which may be very dainty and easily digestible, but it is hardly a meal. The meal comes from the actor. And it seems to me I don't care about the table at which I eat a good meal. I care about the company in which I eat it and the quality of the food. And the quality of the food depends above all on the actor, it seems to me. Now, the Arts Council, first of all, had a great crisis because they discovered that they were spending far too much money in London, not enough money in the region. Good reason for why in the theatre, because the theatre is organised around London. And feed London, you actually feed the region. But the bureaucrats did not understand it. And they started to take money away from London and put it into the region. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. It just sunk without trace in some cases. But that was an interesting change. But now we are faced with theatres having to raise as much money from, if they want to get more money, they have to raise X number of pounds from what's called private industry. And then the government will give them another X. But unless they get so much money from private sponsorship, that's the word, it tends to mean local industry or national industry. Unless they get that money, they're not going to get any more money from the state, while at the same time, the central subsidy is dwindling. Now, it seems to me this is very dangerous for numerous reasons. First of all, the amount of time it takes to go putting around commercial concerns and try to persuade them that Project X or Project Y is worth their support. Because you're talking to people in most cases who know nothing about theatre, whose judgment of what you're asking money for depends on chiefly something called prestige. The Royal Opera House can get all sorts of business sponsorship, and those firms get special privileges with bars, private bars, with opera galas, and things like that, where they can invite business colleagues from overseas and this, that, and the other to enjoy their hospitality. But, and the Royal Shakespeare Company has had some sort of success in that way. But it takes an enormous amount of time, and then it's surprising, you get Ladbrokes betting fund supporting, what you say, symbolism at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now, do you know how much, I know how much Ladbrokes put in there? £20,000. But the cost of the production, if you take the theatre star, the actor's salary, and everything else into account, is something like £300. So to get £20,000 to boost up £30,000, and then call the production by courtesy of Ladbrokes, it seems to me a kind of dishonesty of an appalling sort. But dishonesty is all right. I will be dishonest where it's necessary and where I make it perfectly clear I am being dishonest. But it's the effort which goes into getting it, which, and unfortunately, people like Nagel will only talk to the artistic director of the theatre. Anybody else is a kind of second-class citizen. And so the people whose minds and imagination ought to be going into the development of the company policy and the choosing of the right people to join the company, they spend their time soft-footing along the corridors of power. It's dreadful. Yeah.
You don't have a bell.
Oh, I see.